Anything said in this podcast is our opinion, and while our aim is to explore the weird and wonderful world of humans in a non-judgmental way, we apologize if we don't always achieve this perfectly. It goes without saying that this podcast is for entertainment purposes and should not be taken as medical fact or in lieu of professional advice. Enjoy the show. Hello, my name is Emma.
And I'm Danny.
And welcome to our brand new podcast, What's Not Wrong With Us?
Where we will share our interest in the human experience, from toxic overthinking to the art of complaining and everything in between, and most of all, what's not wrong with us.
Are there times when you feel out on your own, afraid that you're the only one? Something strange, something unique. Is it you?
Is it me?
Well, we're here to tell you what's not wrong with you. What's not wrong with us?
So what have we got planned for today, Danny? I'm genuinely asking because I have forgotten.
So today, Emma, we have a journey. A journey that will take us from existential anxiety to constantly getting into bad relationships to asking ever more if that cat's okay, and rounding off with what we found on TikTok most recently.
Okay, so first of all, Danny, will we talk about this idea of when you try to plan the whole relationship from the first 30 minutes of meeting somebody?
Let's get right into this.
I feel like we both have different experiences that we can draw on from this.
Yes.
Tell me about your experience.
So I say this in the full knowledge that at some point in the future, I would like a human being in this world to choose me as their husband. Mm-hmm. So, listener, if you're out there, please, I am a fully rounded human. I have lots of facets. This is just one of them. We're doing this for the betterment of humankind. So please.
And also, if you're at all interested, yes, you can email us.
Indeed,
that.
Indeed. My number will not be online, but you'll find me somehow, I'm sure. So it comes from this idea that when I meet someone, I have this very immediate sense of a kind of pros and cons list that forms in my head. Mm-hmm. And that pros and cons list, which I think is kind of a common practice amongst people, because you hear that old adage that, you know, first dates are like a job interview where you're kind of assessing like how compatible is this person with my compatibility.
Yeah.
And then that compatibility for me anyway very quickly evolves into I like this and I like that and I like this and I like that. And then the train is starting to pick up some steam here. Uh-huh. And I have been like, well, the next 6 months, like, bear in mind that the other person's maybe speaking to me in this moment while I'm having this little sort of daydream about how this is all evolving. The next 6 months, because he's like this and he's like that and he's like the other and he's like this. Mm-hmm. So, for example, he may be enjoying music, or maybe he is a big foodie, or maybe he is ambitious when it comes to his work or something. Mm-hmm. And then I can sort of start then putting these very unfounded jigsaw pieces down on a board and really ramming them together in a way that nature did not intend. But I will make sure, by God, that they fit together in this 20 seconds that has just passed since this person's come into my life for the first time. Rolling on then to, we've now had our starter in this meal in my mind where we're having this first date. And at the starter, he's maybe then discussing more about his life, or worse still, asking me to input into a conversation that's happening in front of me. Mm-hmm. And instead, I'm thinking about our first two children and what they'll be called and where they'll go to school, maybe. And what will my mother think about them? And why would she feel about that? And where will this all fit together in the life that's going forward? So that is a kind of hyperbolic example of it. But it's that idea of, rather than trying to see the relationship in those very early, very primordial stages for what it is, instead trying to figure out how it fits into your 5, 10, 15 year plan.
Yes. Well, I suppose we are very much people that have 5, 10, 15 year plans. You and I have that in common. And
A type personalities say I.
So I do think we're planners. And we tend to think about the, we're thinking about all angles of a given situation in various different time frames. And it's hard to keep that out of a kind of romantic situation.
Yes.
And I think that I'm trying to think about it less in terms of, because I think a lot of people will find this concept familiar in the stereotype of, you know, the needy woman meets a man and immediately has him married off in her head. You know, I think like Bridget Jones, I think of like, you know, all those kind of scenarios where it's seen as kind of pathetic that that person be imagining that in the very early stages. People will be familiar with that concept, but I think that it's really understandable and common that somebody would have this kind of way of thinking, particularly if you are a future-focused person. I'm really future-focused. I'm always thinking about, what does this mean? How can we, you know, fit together, you know, all the time. I'm thinking about that.
I think it's one of these things, and I think for me, that is very much in tandem with this idea of really worried about wasting time and very concerned about time not being well spent. I think that's where I kind of tying in that kind of existentialness of it all, because for me, I've always had this very kind of congruent thought of, like, you know, life is on a ticking clock and you have only so many minutes that you have to do whatever you're going to do. I'm one of these people who's like a, if not me, who, if not now, when kind of mentalities. And I think quite destructively sometimes it factors into this in a more romantic sense, because it's like, well, if not now, when? Like, when is this going to happen? And I think, I mean, I finished a very long relationship and then had a sequence of shorter relationships, or as my sister would call them, emotional timeshares, wherein there was very quickly a sense of, this is not going anywhere, I need to end this now. But in the earlier times in each of those, there had been a very quick and easy kind of formula I'd done in my head of, okay, in the next month, what's going to happen with this? In the next 6 months, in the next year, in the next 18 months? Because I think it was this idea of, does this jigsaw piece, whether through sheer will and determination, fit into my life or not? And I think the difficulty comes in then, because for me then, just really flexing my self-aware muscle here, I think there's a part of it where you're not living in whatever the situation that's in that moment.
That is the difficulty, for sure.
But can I tell myself that when I'm in those moments? Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. No, no. I want the white dress. I want the chapel. I want it tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, I do think it's understandable. And I think it's based on this emotional need to have your life be a certain way and look a certain way. And that's a goal that you have for yourself. And so, I mean, the time running out thing, or not the time running out, I think from a female perspective, you kind of tend to think about, oh, well, I literally have a biological time limit on when I have to do this. And unfortunately, that comes along with an unbelievably strong urge to have children, like an irrationally strong urge to have children, so that there's definitely a time constraint there. But I find it interesting that you have always had this time, you know, don't waste time, and, you know, if not now, when, and all that kind of stuff. Because I have always felt that I was the kind of person who was running to catch up with my older siblings and, you know, always in a rush to, in my teenage years, I was basically in a rush to grow up. That was the whole perspective. And then I was in a rush to get married. I was in a rush to have children. But I've never had the concrete thought that you have expressed of this kind of idea of, you're otherwise you're wasting time. I didn't ever really, you know, solidify it in that way. So I'm quite interested.
Well, I think it's because
you've identified it in yourself.
It's interesting because I think on one hand, what you've spoken about reads to me with this kind of like ambitious pursuit. Like, it's that kind of like that want to grow, that want to evolve. But I think the motivation for us is maybe different. And I, hand on heart, don't know where I place the source of where that kind of this burning candle life mentality that I've kind of developed. I don't know where it's come from.
Yeah.
But I think it's something that I definitely have had for as long as I can remember. And also, it's part of, you know, it factors into pretty much every aspect of my life. Like, when it comes to my career or anything else, I don't settle well for long periods of time, because I feel like, not necessarily that there's the next big thing coming, but just this sense of, is this the best of what I can have right now?
Yes.
For me.
But is that not a very similar thing? Because I do feel like I was always looking to the next thing, which might have been maybe a milestone achievement, or marriage, baby, whatever, in some people's eyes. But I mean, you are at a very young age to be at the career stage that you are. Most of the other people at the same level of you in your career are probably nearer retirement than they are at the start of their career.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that there's definitely a similarity in those two approaches, although there's definitely different motivating factors. But I always was accused of not being satisfied with what I had.
Yeah.
Because I was always thinking about, you know, the next thing, the marriage, the next qualification, you know, the next baby. I was always accused of not being satisfied with what I have. And I suppose I have reached a point where I am sort of satisfied with what I have, like really genuinely. And the next thing that comes along is more a kind of a me wanting to make sure that there's, you know, growth and change and development in a much calmer way. So maybe it's a product of youth, of trying to get
there. I think so. I think it's definitely a product. And I think it's definitely, without getting too psychological and all of this, I mean, we are all definitely products of our parents. And my parents from forever have really drilled into us ambition and really drilled into us this, like, we are on this earth to grow into our most, you know, final form of ourselves and into our fullest form of ourselves. And you felt that kind of push, or we call it in our family the gentle badgering, I think, to kind of move and grow. And I think for me that formed into this strong push and feel that, you know, if you were stagnant, then you were failing, and you had to kind of constantly be looking for the evolution. I suppose, though, as I've got older, the conscious thought has become, don't grow for growth's sake, grow for this idea of, you know,
where becoming are you trying more to go?
Well, exactly. Yeah. You know, you can just grow and grow and grow, but grow to what? Like, because then you come overinflated and then you can't do whatever you're actually tasked with doing.
And I think what the negative product that I had of trying to grow too quickly was that I rushed some of the times when I should have been taking more in.
Yes.
And
now
I kind of feel like, you know, I wish I had paid more attention. And now I have to kind of do that, do some of the groundwork that I maybe should have done before. But in terms of this approach in relationships.
Sorry, yes.
No. Just to draw it back to that again. So has that worked out well?
It has not. I am staring at my ring finger and it is quite naked. So what I would say is that I think I, again, was in a relationship for a period of time that definitely did not have the growth in it that I wanted, and had factors that made it quite difficult to feel like there was possibility for growth there. Beyond that, then, when that finished, and I think because of the seriousness of it, and now that's sort of 2-3-ish years ago now, the relationships and emotional timeshares that have been since then, I think have felt very, very quickly finite, because there has been a problem in that kind of projected planning for what would happen to this relationship going forward. And I really do have to then rely on kind of the emotional support sources around me to work out, you know, is this something that I'm feeling in and of myself that's valid, or am I being a lunatic who's just allowing this kind of inward sense of rush and push and go to kind of just, you know, go nuclear on something that could actually be very good?
Because what I think is that, I think there's two aspects to this. One is that you maybe have a tendency towards over imagining the relationship too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But rather than see that in any kind of a negative way, what if we couple that with the fact that your experience and your wisdom is pointing out red flags more readily than it might have otherwise done? And for me, I'm quite pleased about that, because I think it's a protective factor.
Yeah.
Because if you invested more time in these relationships, then you could end up getting more hurt by them.
100%.
And so that's, I don't want that to happen.
Yeah.
So if I feel like if you use this skill that you have, that you've demonstrated in lots of other areas of your life, is highly successful skill to over imagine the future and how these things fit together, I think your instincts are telling you, but that won't work.
Yeah.
But this part won't work. and this part won't work. And so, you know, and a lot of people are doing this and not in any way aware of it to this level at all, you know, and are making bad decisions as a result of it. But I think you're making good decisions. I think this is a superpower. This is a skill.
So for the cynics who may be out there sort of thinking that it is kind of an over-exaggerated muscle and it's working too hard and is over, I mean, what would the argument be to say about where the line is being drawn and where is the line between, you know, as you say, finding the red flags in a time that sort of protects you from hurt to over-fantasizing about what this relationship's going to be?
Well, I mean, that's hard to know, isn't it? It's a very fine line, and I think that you do have a good support system around you that you can come to. And sometimes when you say something to them about somebody you might be seeing, they might, in shock, spill a vase off a restaurant table and exclaim your name loudly into the posh restaurant. But or not, you know, don't know how they'll react.
No.
But I think, yeah, if you've got other people that you can have a benchmark of, I think there's, I wrote a song recently, actually, it's going to be on the new album.
plug.
Just keep your eye out for that. And it's called Love's Executioner. And Love's Executioner is a book by Irving Yalom. And it's about his experience with clients who were in relationship. And he said something, some quote or something, where he said, "Don't give me a client in love." Like, he hated clients in love or something like that. I think what he was trying to express was something to do with the seeking being better than thinking you found it, sort of thing.
Yeah.
Probably in terms of emotional development. So he's looking for people who are works in progress and emotional development, all that kind of stuff. I could be wildly wrong for all the Irving Yalom fans out there. But anyway, the song just takes its name from the title, but what it's about is about somebody who keeps ending relationships because they are finding fault but they're manufacturing fault in order to end a relationship because that prevents closeness, and that the solution to that is to kind of examine it, to have a look at why you're making those choices and why you keep, you know, executing the loves rather than giving them more of a chance. But it's the same thing, really, is, you know, if you want to see, am I doing this? Am I being too hasty? Am I being overly harsh? Am I being overly self-protective? And that I'm kind of going, oh, no. And I think, you know, knowing the scenarios, I think the answer to that is no, personally.
Yeah.
I don't think you're being over the top about those things at all. I think you're spotting things that are not going to be, you know, really conducive to a long-term, the type of long-term thing that you want, you know. And so there is an argument to say, why waste your time?
Well, 100%. And I think that's kind of where I always end up at. Like, I never finish these relationships and think, oh, that was a, you know, a missed opportunity that I really should have stayed another 3 months in and thought, let's just keep going.
Yeah.
I was always like, okay, that was the best outcome for what that could have been.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad that that's done now. I suppose, though, at the minute, I'm kind of in a place of, I just don't want to. I have no want in me to pursue it, to kind of go down that road. And I think part of that is because, you know, of the last 6 months, my focus has been on my job and career and development that way. And now finally, thank God, there has been some forward movement there. So maybe something in the new year, because we're recording this in December 2022. So,
don't tell them that we've taken a month and a half to put it out.
No. Future Emma, please edit all of this. The point being is that I think it's very easy for me to start putting a lot of pressure on myself very, very quickly about, again, this kind of self-instituted timetable of when things should need to be happening.
Yeah.
Like, I'm 34 next year.
Oh my God, and he's a babe.
And I have this very real kind of existential anxiety about, I don't know, without sounding like I'm kind of taking this biological clock from you, but this like really impending sense of like, what is happening? What is going on? And I think it is that engine in me that powers forward other aspects of my life is pushing forward this romantic aspect in a place that has nowhere to push it forward into. So instead, what I get is this like anxiousness, which is just because it's ambient energy that has nowhere else to go.
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally accept that. But I do think that people, you know, in term, just to go back to the biological thing, I think more and more people have children, you know, at 40, even, you know, beyond that. My parents had me when they were both over 40. They were amazing parents. They were much better parents to me than they were to my oldest brothers who, you know, were 20 years before that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's lots of arguments for saying that there's no, the time frame is you're is sort of self-created in that kind of way. But I do, and I am a believer in that. And I know this is a bit woo-woo, right?
Oh, but hang on, let me just prepare myself.
No, it's a tiny bit woo-woo, but I do think there's got to be some truth in it. You saying, you know, I've got no energy for it at the minute, like I can't, you know, pursue that at the minute, is my first thought was, well, that's the point in the romantic comedy where, you know, you meet the person.
Literally, as I said the words, I was like, oh no, I've entered this into the universe and I'll manifest.
No, but at the same time, I think that there's got to be something about being really in that seeking mode where you're kind of like, oh, is it there? Is it there? Is it there? That is less likely to draw people to you than if you are kind of like, I'm really comfortable and settled in myself, open to things happening, but I'm not, you know, I'm open to them if they're right.
Yes.
Just and only if they're right kind of thing.
I think as well as part of it is that as I got older, I've had more of my life fill out in different ways, that I have more of an establishment of myself. I have more of a sense of self. I have more of a sense of orientation of myself in the world around me. Mm. So it felt, when certainly in my 20s, I just felt like this kind of, you know, wandering kind of ambient creature that didn't really have any real sense of what or who it was. Like in my mind, the analogy is I am that like dandelion seed just flitting around in the wind and landing on any lily pad that'll have me.
Yeah.
And then
and having an anxiety attack. And
I don't want to be here, but I can't get out. I don't know how to get out. But then getting out and being like, oh, thank God, that was a bullet dodged. And then landing in another lily pad where I was like, well, how did I get here as well?
Okay, well, so this is an amazing segue.
Oh my God,
into
it's like
I
did that intentionally.
But just, I just wanted to do a quick message to those in their 20s. I swear to God, it gets better.
Oh my God.
I promise you, it gets better. Every decade has just been better. 30s were so much better than 20s, and it's been going pretty well since I turned 40,
to say. What I would say is, though, to those in their 20s, well, eat and drink as much as you can because your metabolism will never be as fast. So enjoy it. Go for it. Have all the McDonald's.
So, yes, when you are that floating piece of dandelion fluff and you get caught in one bad situation and you free yourself from it with a great effort, usually.
Yeah, and a lot of people as well. It takes a village.
Yes, and you find yourself flitting off into and immediately getting caught in another one. So that's what I wanted to talk about, basically this bouncing between bad relationships. Because I think a lot of people feel like, a lot of people get stuck in this kind of situation where they feel like I've had a series of bad relationships. Or you see it in other people. So for me, it's I have not had that personally because I've had two relationships really in my adult life. So I can't really speak to my own experience. But I do see it in other people. So you, for example, this person who I will call Joan, and I literally plucked that off the top of my head, okay? So Joan got married and quickly discovered that the man that she married was very difficult to live with, had a drink problem, separated from the man, started a divorce proceedings with the man, and then found another partner who she thought, this is much better person. He's good to me in the way that this other person wasn't good to me. And then started to discover that this person had a drink problem. And you know, in talking about this scenario with people I knew, there was a kind of a sense of, oh, really? Oh, I wonder why she ended up with. So there's this kind of assumption that people make when they hear this type of story, like people ending up with a series of violent partners or a series of partners who are narcissistic or a series of partners who have a drink problem or something like that, that that it is not a surprise, right? And I find that quite interesting that people are, oh, well, I'm not surprised, as if this girl is somehow predetermined, you know, like she's predisposed to alcoholic people. And I don't think that that's necessarily the case, because when we choose a partner, we don't go, I mean, you're going to probably say I'm wrong about this because of Tinder and all that kind of stuff, which I don't really know anything about, but we don't go, we don't look at an available pool of 100 people at once and go, that person. Usually you just run into a person somewhere.
I was going to say, maybe in like the late 1990s, early 2000s. But I think, well, I think to be fair to the dating populace at the minute, a lot more people are seeing 100 people and filtering out by height and filtering out by job and filtering out by, and if you pay for the premium, filtering out by a whole load of other things as well.
Well, you see, because what the problem with that is, it sort of leaves the Freudian explanation, really, you know, that people are unconsciously choosing, repeatedly choosing alcoholics.
Yeah.
Probably because of a complex that they have about their father figure in their lives.
Oh my God, this is not a psychological podcast. Steer away.
It's just that, you know, I can't help going there sometimes, but... I suppose I'm just interested in this idea because I do see it a lot. I see people, you know, I mean, in terms of abusive relationships, there is a lot of information that we know about why people go from one abusive relationship to another, because they're stuck in the abuse cycle. So when they get out of the abuse cycle with one partner, it's natural that they start to reenact it with another partner, and they're vulnerable to people who can, you know, manipulate them and do that kind of thing. But I think this kind of this, you know, presumably this was a random choice that this person made with this, with the second partner, who also turned out to be an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm. Both partners were alcoholics.
Yeah. So she married somebody who was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And then separated, got a divorce, got together with somebody else who turned out to be an alcoholic.
And then that's whenever the whole diatribe of, you know, she chose this again and no one is surprised and everything started coming to the surface.
The attitude that I've noticed from people when you're talking about this kind of thing is like people go, oh, yeah, another alcoholic, is it? I'm not surprised.
So I think, I mean, there's a couple of things that came to mind. I think, first of all, the masses in general love the I told you so statement. They love that kind of position of, well, I knew that. I saw that coming. It is blatantly obvious to everyone, including Mystic Meg. I think the second thing then is, as you said, depending on what magnetism someone is giving off, and I mean the abuse cycle is a good example of that in the sense that, you know, there's a certain resonance that people give off because of experience, because of learned behaviour, because of where they're at, that then kind of draws that people to them. But I think beyond that then, when it's just maybe more of a personality basis, I think there's a part to question around those very negative aspects of that person's personality. The other side of that coin, I think there's aspects that then present in a more positive light. Like there is a, you know, if people are hyper confident and hyper outgoing, they can then sometimes be also very domineering and be very controlling. And sometimes can be the one coin. It can be the same person, same trait, but just different stimulus creates different outcomes.
Yeah. I think that, you know, whenever, if your own self-esteem is low, right, and you're seeking a partner and things like that, I think that you can be vulnerable to the same type of people who will tell you what you need to hear, which is that you're brilliant and they'll do a lot of love bombing. So, for example, I can totally understand why people repeatedly choose narcissistic partners because it's so charming at the start and you're continually convinced this is not the same. Yeah. This is better than it was. This person is nice to me and that person was awful to me, because you're remembering the end of a horrible narcissistic relationship with one partner, and the start of a narcissistic relationship with another partner is totally different. It's all love bombing and gifts and brilliant and wonderful and everything. And so I suppose I wonder, in situations where it's, because it's not, that's not obvious anyway, when you're kind of trying to suss somebody out and see, are they okay? Are they, well, they got problems? What's the situation there? It's not always obvious at the start. But I wonder if your own self-esteem is low, are you then more vulnerable to those kinds of traits that come along with, say, narcissism or say alcohol problems? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. So I think, again, like, so if we take the alcohol problems as an example, I think there's definitely a part of that where in some scenarios alcoholism plays itself out in a, you know, they are the first person to be looking for a good time, they're the first person to be looking for that kind of, let's go out, let's go get drunk, let's go to food, and that in the very initial phases is very lovely, because it's fun and light, and, you know, especially if someone's come out of a really dark kind of you know, the far end of that alcoholic relationship where it is, you know, maybe bordering on abusive, or it's maybe very difficult or challenging or whatever else, that next step going into that is amazing, because it's like, oh my God, love is in the air and I'm being wined and dined and it's all these things that I want, because, you know, God knows I've needed it over the last wee while I haven't had it. So I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it then, as you'd said, is that it can be, I've totally lost my train of
thought. But I'm going to interrupt you, because what I'm thinking is that I accept all those things, and I remember actually whenever I was briefly single there between the two relationships that I've had.
That blip.
I was with some other single girls and we were talking about things, and at one point she was talking about somebody that she was seeing who didn't drink, and they had gone for like maybe a lunch date or something, and we were like, are you going to have sex sober? Like, you hardly know this person.
Oh God.
And but that's the thing. So at the start of a relationship, it's all social things and drinking and stuff like that, right? Mm-hmm. And that's across the board, whether this person turns out to be an alcoholic or not an alcoholic. But I suppose what my question is then, it's not how can you tell or why do you not tell? It's why do people repeatedly end up in the same situations again, because definitely you can't tell.
Yes.
You know, there's it's impossible to tell, except if the person is teetotal. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think as well as that, for, you know, Joe and Jane blogs out on the street, I don't know, there's part of it that strikes me that, you know, the lifespan on memory and these things can be shorter, because the initial experience with the new person who maybe, you know, has a lot of the similar traits to the person before will not be exactly the same as the far end of the person you're with before.
Mm.
You know, someone, unless they have a really, like, you know, negative sense of self, is not going to walk into another relationship that from the off has all the same problems that they can clearly see from the off. I think the difficulty becomes is that all of those red flags don't rear their head from the very beginning.
Yeah, of course.
And secondly, I think, we're talking about alcoholism here very linearly. The people are multifaceted, and that will be one facet of their personality or their person or being. They'll have other facets as well that might be more forward in those initial days, weeks, months. And that means then that you're already in days, weeks, months, and then you're like, oh shit, I'm here again. I've got in this position again.
Yeah.
And the difficulty then becomes, it becomes, and it looks like a pattern, but you on the inside are sitting like, but I didn't know this was going to be a pattern when I'm here.
I know. And also, I think there is a distinction between people, you know, genuinely trying to make an assessment and thinking, yes, this seems safe, this seems good, I'm not going to make the same mistakes again. And people who are honestly not making that kind of assessment and just are happy that somebody is interested in them and would rather be in something bad than be alone. You know, I think there's a definite distinction between those two things. But the bottom line is that, you know, there's nothing wrong with you if that is how you, if you've had that kind of scenario. Often it's because you're young or because, you know, your self-esteem needs built up. But there's nothing wrong with you if you choose, you know, badly.
He chose poorly.
And also there's nothing wrong with you if you imagine the wedding bells in the first 30 minutes of meeting somebody.
Yeah.
I think you just, that is a testament to your personality. And often it can be a great skill and a very protective thing.
I mean, we shall see, won't we? Now I've put this out into the universe. I'm giving this 3 months and then we'll see where we fare.
Well, there's going to be a line of men holding out flowers.
Oh my goodness, a line of men. Valentine's Day will be very interesting.
So, Danny, I know that you have something for our TikTok segment.
I do.
Is it a new thing, Danny, or is it a
follow-on thing? So, again, another preface. I do not have some sort of fascination with placenta. However, when these things present themselves to you, it is like a moral obligation, I think, to share.
Yeah.
And sharing is what I'm doing. So, for the purposes of our conversation, I'm going to try and play the TikTok and then on no sound so that we can see what's up.
We
can talk as it's happening.
Okay, go.
And I'm just hopeful that it's going to load and play as I'm talking about this. So this TikTok, which we'll link attached to this, is about what's called a lotus birth. And in this, as I'm staring at my phone as it's not playing, it's basically where they do not detach the placenta from the baby when it's born and just keep it attached for what this lady said to be anywhere between 3 to 10 days post-birth. And so Emma and I, before we started recording, had a conversation because on the TikTok you'll be able to see, you can see a picture or a video, sorry, of the placenta in what looks like some sort of wicker basket and a puppy pad underneath it. And then it's doused with various salt and herbs and almost looks like some sort of dry rub that you'd put on steak.
Yeah.
And then Emma was like, well, that's to try and negate against the smell that obviously would happen as this piece of organic material begins to slowly decompose. So I suppose, again, to kind of hark back to conversations previous, this, I mean, I will never be giving birth to children myself. I am just so curious and interested. Now, to be fair, the lady who was doing the TikTok had some very interesting points around the benefits of doing it this way. They talked about how much blood that the baby was able to get back because the placenta stayed attached to them. Yes. So before Emma has points, I'm just going to give the full pros here because, again, there's nothing wrong with this mother who's choosing this. We're just trying to understand a little bit more about it and, you know, just talk about these things because it's interesting. So the lady said that there was a lot more blood given back to them. It's less traumatic for the baby. And there's a lot of like stem cells and goodness that's in the placenta that otherwise just gets wasted, gets lost. And because it's only 3 to 10 days, there's no real harm in it. It's just about keeping the baby close to the placenta basket until such time as this naturally
so
kind of ends.
So inconvenient. Like, so I have a lot of thoughts,
yes,
right?
So go.
So first of all, when you do look at the TikTok, you will see that this baby is having to lie near to a bucket, right?
Yes.
And I would find that, I know the idea of staying in your house with your baby for 10 days is lovely. Like if you, you know, had this, what is it, confinement that they had, you know, in the olden days. But it's not super practical for modern living. Like I was 8 days after I had Charlie, I was out buying Sam's school uniforms because Charlie was born in August and Sam needed different school uniform bits. So so it's not super convenient to have your baby beside a bucket at all times.
No.
And it's not you know, like the cord is unreasonably long when you see it. Like you really don't think it's going to be that long. You think it's going to be like maybe a foot long between the baby and the placenta.
No,
it's super long.
Like a meter.
So my first problem is that you actually really want the baby to lose the little bit of cord that is left on. You can't wait for that to happen because it can get knocked by the nappy, it can get irritated, all that kind of, you're like, oh, I can't wait till that little bit of cord falls off. So the idea of having an entire placenta attached to the baby is, you know, it just doesn't seem, I think it's a very niche thing that anybody would really want to pursue that.
Yes.
So the thing about the health benefits, so the placenta, when the baby is born, the cord is still pulsing a little bit with blood. And if you leave the placenta attached for a little bit of time and don't immediately cut the cord, the blood pumps back into the baby. And that's what you're trying to achieve, because it can really help their iron levels for like years,
yeah.
Right? That takes, I was trying to Google it there to find out, but my understanding is that that takes minutes. And that after that point, there's no more goodness to be achieved from, because the placenta, when it's not attached to the mother, is not going to continue pumping blood into the baby. The blood is gone.
Yes.
It's either in the, I nearly said meat of the placenta. I did. I said it. That's the space that I said it. It's either in that large, you know, jellyfish disc part of the placenta,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And it won't, it can't come out of that.
Yes.
Except if you eat it, as we've talked about in the last episode,
yes.
Right? Or it's in the baby.
Yes.
Like it's not in the cord. You can the cord is white. You can see in the video the cord doesn't have any blood in it, and the placenta isn't able to pump anything back into the baby at that stage. So I think the thing is that it's not actually doing anything apart from in their minds. It's doing something. And then you're having to put these herbs on, and it's just... I just don't see the point in it. I really don't see the point in it. And if they feel good about it, grand.
Yeah.
I do have a question about hygiene. I do have a hygiene related question, but I don't have any evidence to back that up. That's just my feeling, is that I'm a bit like, this is biological waste at this point. I think it should be away or buried under a tree.
Or buried under a tree, yeah.
Yeah. But not in your bedroom for 10 days.
So I was trying to think of like a place of knowledge that I could talk to this about. And unfortunately for me, my place of knowledge is farming based.
I love this though.
So,
we're all mammals, baby.
This is the point. So I very obligatorily was part of a farm. I say that as if I was one of the animals. But basically, my mom and dad... sheep farmers, and have a flock that we've had for God knows how many years, like for as long as I can remember, certainly. And then every sort of winter, spring time, we'd come into lambing season. And as part of lambing season, obviously, mammals are born. And with mammals comes placenta, or as we call it, afterbirth. And never, unless something really terrible has happened, did a lamb come out still attached to said placenta. Like, biologically, nature was just like, thing is born, this is done now. And then it was very much either the ewe would eat the afterbirth for nutrition, or probably me having to go out in the field with a shovel in the middle of the night and find it and buck it in a bin somewhere or get rid of it because it attracted foxes and whatever else.
Yeah.
So my thinking on this was, from a nature point of view, if our bodies needed that in some way, why would other mammals not stay attached in more kind of consistent patterns where you'd see it? Or is it instead someone has heard that bit of knowledge, heard that bit of, you know, like you'd said about how there's a couple of minutes where the blood does go back in and so you shouldn't cut immediately. And is this kind of more of like a theoretical practice that is now being acted upon on a larger scale where it's kind of been brought to the fore?
I think so.
That way, because it's just, it strikes me that if this was something that was really beneficial for life and beneficial for, you would see other examples of it across.
Yeah, well, I think we do have a slightly different birth situation because we do stay attached to the placenta, and that's why we have belly buttons and other animals don't. But and because we, you know, when we evolved, we had to have our big stupid brains. So, you know, so we can't walk, but we're, you know, developmentally our brains are large for birth time. But so I looked it up, and so delayed cord clamping is, because I had heard about this when I was pregnant, and I said to you the last time we were talking about placentas, which seems like quite frequently at the minute, but
I promise,
okay,
this is the end of, unless TikTok gives me another one, and then it'll be a trifecta of placenta.
I was quite interested in this idea of feeling that cord blood was valuable and there was a lot of stem cells in it and maybe could it be saved. And we just don't have the infrastructure in place to do that in any way. But there certainly wasn't a rush to cut the cord.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it was cut, there honestly was nothing going on with that cord. So I think between 5 and 30 minutes, like mostly it stops pulsating quite quickly, and sometimes it can be a bit longer. But I don't know of any medical reason why the placenta should be kept attached to the baby.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I don't, you know, apart from the kind of like, why would you bother? It seems a bit of a hassle to have this bucket around your baby for 10 days. And a question about infection, because, you know, whenever they cut the cord and the cord is there and it's shriveling up, like, you know, you want to keep that area clean and you would worry about it getting irritated or infected or anything like that. And I just feel like if there's this big thing which is gradually kind of decaying attached to the baby, would that be of any risk to them? But I don't have any basis.
Well, I think that's important to say that, you know, neither of us are medical professionals. Yeah. So we are purely going off a less than a minute TikTok video, which has then spurred all this conversation.
Yeah.
And I think to be very careful for both of us, that neither of us are coming from a place of judgment. It's just from a place of conversation, and just saw something that sparked conversation, which I hope is kind of the kind of real sentiment middle of all of this. And I think as well, you know, with any luck, this will be stuff that people maybe haven't seen themselves. And, you know, then again, start a journey of conversation and discovery around what this could be. Beyond that, and as well, I'm just struck by the fact that how many times in medical development and history have things been done that people have scoffed at and think, well, that's odd and strange, why are you doing that way? And now, years later, is common practice. Now, do I think that is necessarily going to be this? I don't know, but who knows?
No, and I think, you know, just to add to that point about lack of judgment, we are trying to be careful not to be judgmental, because it's easy to do that when, and this is not, we don't want this to be a kind of thing where we observe the people doing things and go, they crazy.
Point and laugh.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I hope that comes across, but we are trying to be careful about doing that. And for anybody who has like strong placenta feelings.
Yes.
We are not judging you. We just don't fully, you know, we're just not in the same place as you. And I hope you don't judge us for just discarding our placentas.
My placenta was discarded for sure. I have also discarded placentas. Therefore,
you have a lot of placenta. You have much more placenta experience than me.
I honestly could not tell you the amount of placentas that I have seen in my life.
Wow.
And how many horrific sheep-based births I have seen in my life. It honestly is more than I think the normal human.
Yeah, I think that is a particular type of life experience when you've like delivered multiple animals.
Oh my God.
So, our final segment.
Just to understand what's happening, Emma is frantically looking for a photo.
Well, so here's the problem, right? I was hoping that I could do something really clever, but it felt too contrived.
Yeah.
I was hoping that I could do something really clever when we were talking about lack of judgment.
Yes.
Because what I'm struggling with Nextdoor is that, is not judging people, I guess. Mm. So I think it's more that there's a lot of people who are just saying very ordinary stuff like, I would recommend this plumber. He came out, was pleasant, and fixed the pipes.
Yes.
And I would recommend him. And what I've started to do now is I'm categorizing Nextdoor posts. I've spent quite some time on there, and I actually just posted some shoes for sale as well. But and then you've got people who are just introducing themselves. Tons of people going, hi, I'm new to the area. What bins do we put glass in? The answer is none.
Unless you live in certain areas that allow you to put caddies.
You have to take them to a bottle bank. And then we have had some drama recently. So you shared a post with me, which was coincidentally at the same time that another piece of similar drama was going on Nextdoor. So you shared a post with me where...
Oh, this is good. Okay.
This person has posted on Nextdoor and saying, would not advise asking this person to fix anything. Cost us £60 for him to misdiagnose what was wrong with our washing machine, which literally blew up 10 minutes after he fixed it. So first of all, I want to know how literally she's meaning. Because if it really blew up, that's quite bad. But also £60 for a call out for somebody to go, oh, it's such and such. I mean... That seems fairly standard.
Yes. So I should also say that this post, that post is in context of at least 20 other posts, which are just really singing the praises of this person.
Yes.
And very like, amazing, couldn't be more helpful. Uh-huh. All of the very traditional next door type stuff,
yeah.
Which is why I think this, the one I sent you, Emma, was particularly kind of like, oh my God. And the woman had the balls to stick it in the thread, mm-hmm. of all of this really like high praise stuff.
Yeah.
So very easily got backable to the original tradesperson, kind of thing, plumber, I think it was,
uh-huh.
Who did that in the first place. So I thought that was interesting. I think the...
Did you see his reply at all?
I did not see. I didn't even know he had replied.
Well, no, I think she probably took it down because that's usually what happens in these scenarios. So I looked him up.
You've been following this? Like, just like
well, I looked him up and he has been like... Usually a bad tradesperson, there's very little engagement. There will be one shoddily constructed advert, which will have some bad, you know, Photoshop stuff on it. And then there'll be some recommendations. Would recommend, came out, fixed thing, very good.
Yeah.
But this guy is like, is really engaging and next door is engaging with the neighbourhood, you know, generally, and has loads of really highly positive recommendations. Mm-hmm. So this person, who I shall not name.
Yeah, this time.
I think that she's one of the category of people who thinks that they have been mistreated by somebody,
yes.
when actually something has happened that person couldn't maybe control. You know, like people who are like, the man came out and cleaned our gutters and then the roof broke the next day.
Yeah.
Very unhappy with this level of service. And,
yes.
you know, people over-associate things and think that, you know, this person is more responsible than they necessarily are. So I don't know. I mean, I've never had a washing machine blow up. You had a big weird washing machine problem at one point, didn't you?
Did I?
Yeah,
oh, I did.
In your current house?
Yes.
Some sort of really melodramatic watch machine situation.
I mean, sounds like my house. I'm trying to remember what that was. Do you know, I can't actually remember. I remember there being something that happened, but I can't remember what exactly the context of it was. I suppose
that's okay. It didn't explode anyway.
Did not explode. I suppose what I was going to say as well, though, is that what I thought was interesting is that this person, I know it was like she and insert her name, this person... did not appear to want any compensation or come fix this, or you've done this wrong, like make it better.
Mm.
All she wanted was to let everybody know how awful her experience was.
Yeah.
And that her washing machine has now blown up.
Mm.
So my theory on that, or thinking on that, is how did a £60 worth of work result in an appliance that was non-functional go from that to nuclear in your kitchen?
No, I mean, £60 is like a call out and you find a coin in
yes.
the thing. Do you know what
yes.
I mean? Like £60 is you go, oh, right, okay, it's got stuck on this setting or,
mm-hmm.
you know, whatever. That's like the call out fee.
Yes.
So I don't think that the poor plumber did much to that machine other than not spot that it was going to blow up
yes.
shortly afterwards.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I suppose then in terms of next door-isms, where do you think this fares on the, what do you think her motivation behind all of this was? Like, where do you think this fares on the integration with her community?
Well, there's, I'm trying to categorise people. So as we go, there's going to be a developing list, okay?
Yes.
And I can't think, I didn't bring my notebook out, but there is a category of people and you will find them in the comments section as well. And they are like the warners. They're the risk averse people.
Yes.
So they're the ones who say, I would just be careful about putting a chicken carcass out because the foxes might choke on the bones, they splinter, and I know that we're not supposed to give them to dogs. This is actually from a next door post,
yes.
I'm not just
yes.
making this up. I know we're not supposed to give them to dogs and, you know, cats, so I think just be careful, we could hurt a fox. And I just wanted to put that out
yeah.
there. Just you do you,
but
just be cautious. Okay?
Keep the foxes safe.
So they, I mean, that's a very pleasant one because this was a conversation about, I mean, honest to God, the stuff that's on it. So somebody was offering a chicken carcass that they weren't going to use for soup stock to see if anybody wanted it. And then their conversation arose about, well, you could put it out for the foxes.
Mm.
I know our foxes like everything, including chips or something like that. And I'm just thinking about the rats, but never mind.
Do you know what just struck me there as you were speaking? Right, so here's my thought train here. my first stop on this train was, why are you not just throwing this chicken carcass in the bin? Like, why is that not the end of the chicken carcass's journey?
Yeah.
My second thought was, who is the person that's going to take your 2-3-day-old chicken carcass and thinks, I have a list of uses for this?
Mm.
And then my third thought was, any single farming person in the country would be like, waste not, want not. There will be a use somewhere in the... So I'm wondering, has Nextdoor pulled out this kind of... I don't know. I don't want to be using sweeping statements here for like country versus town people, but I've having been both, having lived in the country and then lived in Belfast for a number of years now, I think there is definitely a mentality difference around things like this, things like, you know, waste and food and different things where, and not certainly not all people, but definitely there's a sense of, you know, well, we'll find a use for that. There'll be something you can do with that. There'll be a way of making use for that. Whereas, you know, we have a big, beautiful brown bin that can happily house it as well.
Yeah, we've got, I've got two brown bins and also I think I have six bins. I'm fine for bins. I'm all right for bin space. But
Emma's a bin stockpiler.
We've got some shops near us and I think the mentality has come from the convenience of everything that you can just get another thing or whatever. I mean, I am terrible for waste. Like, I don't want to waste, but I will find myself not, you know, having to throw stuff out. I'm trying to get better at it.
Yes.
But Nextdoor is just one of those places where a lot of stuff happens and there's a concentration of like lost cat posts and lost dog posts. But there
thinking
is also
lost cats, terrible.
Quite random stuff. And then there's a lot of recommendations as well. But at the time that you sent me that anti-recommendation.
Yes.
I mean, I think in terms of the warners, there's probably complaint. There's probably different levels of them as well. So there's ones that are complaining and not willing to listen to reason. And then there's other ones who are like, oh, but that cat could be lost and maybe it's broken its leg and please do something, you know. And they're very nice people, but, you know, they just can't help themselves because they're so anxious. Obviously, they've got, you know, anxiety in themselves. So there was another complaint about a tradesperson on my Nextdoor. So we live in different areas, so our Nextdoors are slightly different. In my Nextdoor, somebody had complained about a tradesperson, had put a really scathing anti-review on about this tradesperson, and then had received harassing phone calls.
Get away.
Because the people were connected because they had done a job. So they had their number, they knew where they lived.
A person had received a job, had then gone to Nextdoor, complained about said job. Mm-hmm. Person who had done said job had obviously seen this and then had started the scathing phone call.
Harassing phone calls and messages. I think messages first and then phone calls, which maybe were not answered.
Do we know
any
of the content of what these harassing messages were?
Well, we know that the person phoned the police.
As in the person who's being harassed?
The person who was being harassed, who had put the original anti-recommendation up, put another new post up saying, I have been advised by the police to take my original post down.
Oh my God,
because of the harassing phone calls. Whatever. And presumably blocked this other person's numbers as well. So, but the damage is done to that person's reputation, whether it was warranted or not, because you don't want to engage with somebody to fix your washing machine if they're going to later, harass you on the phone.
No.
That's like tradesperson 101. No harassment, please. So I saved that post and a couple of other posts to bring to our episode today.
Mm-hmm.
But they're gone now. I don't know whether there's like a time frame whereby you can save Nextdoor posts but I couldn't locate where saved posts would be.
Maybe we will definitely make that a piece of homework.
The app has some problems.
Yes, the app has some definite problems.
Which is another topic for another day.
Mm-hmm.
So
shall we do a summarization?
Yes,
surmising
let's we've got do to. Our summary.
Thank you. I knew there was a tense word where that came in together. So the summary is we've covered the existential anxiety, forward planning, feeling of drive within life and how it pans into your romantic life. We then segued very neatly, I might add, into people who recurringly choose the not best possible people to be in relationships with.
Yeah.
And why this might happen and kind of just a wee bit of kindness towards those people, because
yeah.
I think from the outside looking in, it's maybe very easy to come from a place of, well, why are you doing this to yourself? And
yeah.
instead, it's obviously a much wider faceted issue than that. And then for a bit of levity, moved on to placentas and baskets, lamb birth and all of the joy that comes with that, and finished off then with the great cacophony that is next door.
Oh, what joys will it continue to bring to my life?
Honest to goodness. I think more than anything else, just the conversation is just wonderful. Just truly wonderful.
And yes, that's us. We do have a little ending thing that we can remember what it is.
So I suppose, Emma, I will say to you with greatest of sincerity, I feel like still, even now, there is nothing wrong with you.
And there's nothing wrong with you, Danny.
Wonderful. I'm delighted. What a wonderful, warm sentiment to leave into the night with.
Yay!
Another one done!